Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. Expresspros.com.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
It is currently 6:15. I've been looking at different weather forecasts, trying to figure out the chance for showers today. And one forecast I'm looking at says there's a possible risk of severe weather today. Wind and hail are possible. Well, wind is the greatest threat. And then they say we have a 24% chance for showers. Well, the lady from the National Weather Service yesterday said there was about an 80% chance for showers today. And I don't understand what's going on. Tomorrow, they're saying scattered thunderstorms, 53% chance for showers. Again, what I was hearing from the different weather people was an 80% chance for showers if you're going to Jazz Fest. So I don't quite know how that works with if it's a 40% chance of rain where you are or a 40% chance for everybody getting rain. But either way, get ready. There could be some rain today or tomorrow. We're going to try to talk about tariffs and supply chain shortages with this professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. We're having a hard time getting them. President Trump saying that the kids are going to have to get maybe two toys this year, two dolls instead of 30, which led me to do some checking. And I found out that Nintendo is getting ready to lay off a Mario brother and that Yoshi is going to have to take a pay cut. Thanks to my kid playing video games for the background of craft that joke. But the president says there's going to be some pain before some gain. And that got me to thinking about how much pain are you willing to put up with and how do you gauge gain? And with America, with a free economy, it would seem like you can get as many dolls as you want if you have the money, right? Instead of two, instead of 30. But how are you looking at these tariffs? Because I can understand the pain if there is gain. But how are you going to measure the gain? And if it's a tariff just for the sake of tariff, well, that's one thing. But the other thing is when it comes to bringing manufacturing back to the country, if, say, dolls are being manufactured in the country, is that where you want to work or is that where your kid wants to work in a doll manufacturing plant? Or do you want somebody else to do that? Do you want your kid or yourself working in a manufacturing plant that makes shirts or what have you? Or would you prefer somebody else do that in a different area? Because I think it goes to you got to watch what you ask for because you might just get it, right? So if the tariff is to bring manufacturing back and it's just a threat and it doesn't change anything, I guess that's a couple of different issues. Major retailers, including representatives from Walmart and Target, met with Trump, and they discussed how tariffs would affect their imports. So let's go to our guest right now. I understand he's ready, Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. How you doing, Patrick?
Good morning, Tommy. Good. How are you?
I'm okay. I was getting around before you came on and said that with the tariffs, Nintendo was going to have to lay off a Mario brother and Yoshi was going to have to take a pay cut.
That sounds about right, Tommy. It's not looking good in regards to what's happening into the economy with tariffs.
So let's talk about that, because the president said that shelves are going to be open. Maybe the children will have two dolls instead of 30. Maybe the two dolls will cost a couple of bucks more. Now, I can understand sacrifice if we're in times of war or those kind of things, but this is sacrifice based on a president's plan. Is that accurate or not? I'm not taking on President Trump or anything else. I'm just talking about, in reality, what we're talking about bottom line here.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I don't have, you know, political ideology. I don't really go either way. I'm an independent just for all, you know, just to, you know, our cards on the table. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the issue is that is there a plan? And I think that's kind of what's happening. We're not really sure, you know, what the plan is. So you enact tariffs and then you decide, hey, we're going to do some exemptions and then the tariffs on everything. And it just seems like the consumer or your listeners are the ones that are going to suffer the most because of these tariffs.
When it comes to the time frame of this, in the abstract, it's like, okay, yeah, sure, there's going to be this, there's going to be that, it's going to be that. But when it comes to actually hitting the pocketbook or hitting the supply chains or what's going to be on the shelves, what's the time frame on that, Patrick, as far as you know now? Because maybe we should take a step back, because I don't even know where we stand with tariffs now, what's exempt, what's not, what the tariffs are on. I know I saw a news piece yesterday about stuff from China, baby doll, baby clothes, I think it was, or strollers or those kind of things that are subject to the 145% tariffs on China. Tell me who collects that, who's paying that now, what's the situation?
Yeah, so let me explain, Tommy, especially to your listeners. So how a tariff works is, let's say I'm in New Orleans and I buy pens, and the pen is a dollar, and I buy those pens from China. So when they come into the port, what will happen is customs will charge me 145% of my, you know, my dollar pen. So in essence, I'll be paying another $1.45 in addition to the dollar.
The importer.
So that money, yes. The importer. Yeah. So custom collects that. That goes to the government. The importer now is paying $2.45 for that pen that used to cost them a dollar. So that's kind of how the tariffs are working. And so our three largest trading partners are Canada, Mexico, and China. And so those are the three that we really should be focused on. So Mexico and Canada are being hit with that universal 10% tariff in addition to other tariffs with aluminum and steel. I think it's about 25%. And then with China, it's 145%. So this is, you know, as far as what we're seeing in the ports, because the retailers, I think, were kind of waiting to see exactly what was going to happen with Trump's policies. And I think they were expecting some type of exemptions. So they have been ordering. And so we have seen it. And actually, the next 2 weeks, there will be 35% less ships than we've seen last year. Overall, it's like 40. We're down about 40% as far as the amount of ships that are going through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and that's the gateway from Asia. That's usually where all your imports are coming from. So, Tommy, to answer your question, we'll probably start seeing bare shelves, I would think, in the middle of the summer. So that's what I would see, and it's going to be across the board. I think most of your listeners will probably see it with apparel, clothing, shoes. When you go into a Walmart or a Target, you'll start to see those consumer products not on the shelves. And so it'll be kind of alarming if you're a consumer.
I get a text here from a number, an ardent Trump supporter, apparently says, "Oh, y'all can't suffer a little with the tariffs. No pain, no gain. Suck it up." And I understand that, but we'll talk about what the gain would look like, ultimately what the end game is, because pain for the sake of pain is nonsense. 622 Traffic Now, WWL. Me, Tucker, WWL, talking about tariffs with Patrick Penfields, professor of supply chain management at Syracuse University. Professor, when it comes to people talking about no pain, no gain, when it comes to the pain that's being felt right now, to be clear, if we're going to follow the money, doesn't matter if it's Democrat, Republican, whomever, the money that people are paying for tariffs right now is going to the U.S. Treasury, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. And then somebody else says, so this guy is okay with unfair trade balances where the USA is holding the short end of the stick. But when it comes to trade balances or imbalance of trade, that's not necessarily a bad thing for the U.S. economy, is it?
Absolutely not, especially for consumers, right? So that's, you know, that's the thing. Competition is what drives down prices, right? So I don't disagree with the president's focus on manufacturing, because manufacturing is what creates wealth. Mm-hmm. It's this scattershot approach, right? You know, it's probably the best analogy I can give you, Tommy, is if you're going to war, you don't want to fight a war on all fronts. You know, just want to fight it on one front. Here we're at war with the whole world, you know, which doesn't make sense. You know, if you're going to go ahead and enact tariffs, let's be strategic about it. Let's really focus on the industries that are really going to create wealth in the United States, such as, you know, car manufacturing, chip manufacturing, medical devices, pharmaceutical, defense. You know, those are the areas that the United States should focus on. Why do we want to get into pen manufacturing or T-shirt manufacturing or, you know, things that, again, are just of low value? That stuff is never really going to make sense to come back here to the States. And unfortunately, you know, this is kind of what we're going to see. We're going to be paying more, especially for apparel, sneakers, shoes. You know, that stuff is, you know, never come back to the United States. And it doesn't make sense for us to do just because it's you know, a low paying type jobs.
So somebody texted in and said, no one can explain how any of this is going to help the average American over the next decade. Can you, Professor?
Yeah, this isn't going to help the average person. And unfortunately, that's the sad part about it is, again, it's a regressive tax. And what that means is that us as consumers are going to pay that tax. So, yeah, the people that aren't paying a lot, that aren't making a lot of money, they're the ones that are going to suffer the most, you know, versus the very wealthy. And I think that's the thing that sometimes people don't understand. So, again, I don't disagree with what the president's doing. He's just not being very strategic about it. And so, again, that's the problem is, again, this is why we're going to see this, you know, this inflation that's going to hit us pretty hard in summer.
So what ideally would you like to see done?
I would like to see a pause on all tariffs and ideally come up with a plan. Let's say, okay, we want to bring manufacturing here to the States. Let's be strategic about it. Let's look at those high paying jobs. Let's look at those jobs that are really going to add value to the United States. Because, you know, manufacturing does create wealth. However, let's be strategic about that manufacturing. Let's let's do this. Let's work one country at a time. Why do we have to have this huge, you know, tariff fight with everybody in the world? Doesn't make any sense. I would focus on our three biggest trading partners and then work our way down. Why are we trying to make trade agreements with, you know, small countries that really we don't import much from? It's silly.
So what would one tariff argument, one tariff being placed on what one country with what product would benefit the United States? If you can give me a case study.
Yeah, so I would probably focus on China. I would reduce, you know, this 145% tariff across the board, because that doesn't make sense. What I would focus on is pharmaceuticals, right? And I'd say, okay, here's what we're going to do with pharmaceuticals. We are going to go ahead and put a tariff on this. And we're going to actually, you know, try to produce our own medicine here in the United States. So that's one. That's one focus I'd have. A couple other maybe is chip manufacturing. I'd say, okay, we're going to put tariffs, you know, increase the tariff level on chip manufacturing because we want the chip manufacturers here because those create really great jobs. And Tommy, in this area, we have Micron that's going to be hopefully building a facility here. Chip manufacturing, you know, just the average salary, there's supposed to be 9,000 employees that are going to be hired at this particular chip plant. The average salary is $100,000, right? That's the type of manufacturing that we want here in the States. So I think chip manufacturing, pharmaceutical manufacturing, and then maybe looking at medical devices. Again, stuff that is really very important here to the United States that, again, you know, we can do well and hopefully create more wealth and actually make people more rich versus poor.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. Not everything President Trump does is good. Not everything he does is bad. I'm all for bringing manufacturing back to the United States, helping out the U.S. economy. But paying tariffs to dump more money into the U.S. Treasury, I'm not really crazy about that, because keep in mind, they're going to spend everything you send them. We'll talk to Bill Cassidy when we come back, 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this Friday morning. It'll be a little bit rainy today, rainy tomorrow, better by Sunday. I'm trying to get a handle on the timing and Jazz Fest and all of that stuff, but I would just say be ready for some rain if it happens. We are joined now by U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy. Yes, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. How are you, man?
I'm okay. You know, I just heard a commercial just now about the tariffs and the economy tanking. I talked about tariffs. The president, Tim, play that soundbite if you would, please. I don't think the president's grandkids are going to have less dolls. It's going to hit people differently when it comes to these tariffs. One thing that does concern me is that any money that's being collected from tariffs is going into the U.S. Treasury, and it seems as though the government's going to spend as much money as you give it. So when it comes to pain and gain and tariffs and long-range plans, not everything President Trump does is good. Not everything he does is bad. Give me your thoughts on tariffs, because you've been a big debt and deficit guy throughout the time you've been in Washington, especially as it relates to Social Security.
Absolutely. So first, let's just say that most Americans think that it's the president. Let me start over. The president has a goal of how do we make this economy more fair to our fellow Americans. And the fact that another country would charge tariffs on our goods that are higher than the tariffs we charge on their goods just doesn't seem fair. And you can speak about specific industries in Louisiana, be it shrimp or rice as commodities or other products, in which our folks feel like they're being put out of business by tariffs and tariff-like activity in other countries. So the president wants to make that fair. And one way is to say, okay, you have a tariff on us, we're going to put a tariff back on you. We've seen the response. Already countries right off the bat, Cambodia, Vietnam, a major trading party, Israel, all came to the table, said, listen, we will lower our tariffs. That's all a positive thing. Now, is it going to be tomorrow? No. But is it a process that they're working through to make this economy more fair for the average American? Yes. And might there be a bump in the road? Yes. But at the end, the goal is to have a better economy for us all, and that's a pretty good goal.
So do you think it's going to work? That, I guess, when it comes to, you know, no pain, no gain, I'm getting texts about that and people that are buying into the tariffs. How much pain, who is it going to affect, and how do we judge gain? How do we know when we've won?
Well, we'll know if Vietnam, who's a major trading partner, if they lower their tariffs so that not only do we have more made in America in the United States, but more made in America in Vietnam, which means the goods we produce can go there without them sicking a big tariff on us, then we've won. Mm-hmm. Now, we'll still get their goods, because our tariffs are lower than theirs. We want them to get our goods, and that creates better jobs for our fellow Americans. That will be the way we will judge it. And that's a good goal. We want better jobs for and more jobs for us. And the president's trying to attack that in a variety of ways. One's the tariffs, but two's the investment. Mm-hmm. And so as we get more investment here, then those jobs will be created. We got a better economy for us all. That's the goal.
Let me ask you about executive orders and the president, because something that keeps sticking in my mind is, I know you and I have had conversations, as have other members of the delegation and local politicians as well, that told me President Biden could change the whole flood insurance program with the stroke of a pen in an executive order. Well, now we got President Trump that's issuing a lot of executive orders on a daily basis. I get them emailed to me every day. We have Mike Johnson, who is the Speaker of the House, Steve Scalise, Majority Leader in the House. It would seem like timing is everything, and if President Biden could fix the flood insurance program or give Louisianians a break with the stroke of a pen, President Trump could do the same thing. And considering Mike Johnson's the Speaker of the House and Steve Scalise, the extraordinary power they have, as a Majority Leader, any chance of that happening, or have you had any conversations about that?
That's a great idea, Tommy.
Well,
again,
thank you.
If we're talking about an economy, economy that works better for us all, then obviously the cost of homeownership is a big deal. And it's on my mind because I've been working with my staff. We've had four or five conversations this past week on flood insurance reform. So it's something front and center. So what I'll ask my staff to do is to send a letter to the president, and we'll communicate directly asking him to do an executive order to fix some of the issues that have been there with flood insurance. What a great idea, and thanks for prompting it.
It would seem like if Biden could do it, then Trump can do it. And we have such influence now in Louisiana. It's like, you know, you got to take advantage of it when you got it, right? Because timing's everything. Let's talk about what else you've been working on, Senator.
Yeah, so we've been working on
fentanyl is a huge issue. We've talked about this before, Tommy. Mm-hmm. And I want to, again, give a prop shout out to the president. In his first 30 days, he lowered illegal immigration across the U.S.-Mexican border to the lowest in decades, and with that disrupted the flow of fentanyl. I passed something called the Halt Fentanyl Act. Why is this important? Tommy, everyone listening knows of somebody affected by fentanyl, oftentimes somebody who's died from an overdose. We now have strategies by which we can give Narcan to reverse the flow of fentanyl, to reverse the effects of fentanyl. So my Halt Fentanyl Act, which has passed the Senate, it'll pass the House soon and be signed into law by the president, says that if a cartel, a criminal, is selling something which is fentanyl-like, not quite fentanyl, but fentanyl-like, it addicts and it kills like fentanyl, then they're just as guilty as if they have fentanyl itself. It's one more tool for law enforcement to go after the criminals promoting people dying from something like fentanyl. Very pleased about that, and I look forward to a signing ceremony where the president signs it, and I'm getting a pen with his name inscribed on it, celebrating the passage.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I was getting ready to ask you, if you can get an executive order signed with flood insurance based on my idea, I sure would like a pen if you can get me one.
You want a pen, brother? I'll get you a pen.
I do. I'm serious. As it relates to flood insurance, if we can get an executive order signed to bring down flood insurance rates and get FEMA under control, and it seems like when you talk about government overreach and bureaucracies that are out of control, FEMA would be one of them, especially with the methodology when it comes to the risk rating 2.0, which I don't think we ever did find out, did we?
Oh, so your point, though, the risk rating 2.0 is a FEMA policy which can be reversed with the stroke of the pen, and we're going to approach the president on that. And I'm optimistic because this president wants to do a series of things which help our fellow American, not the rich guys, but the folks who are driving their 10-year-old pickup truck, going to work, coming home, kissing their spouse, sending the kids off to the softball game in the late evening, and going to watch them. Those are the people he sympathized with, and the cost of home ownership is part of that. If we can lower the cost of flood insurance, that helps those families.
I'm counting on you, Senator. Get it done.
Thank you, Tommy.
Any other final thoughts before we let you go or not? Something else you're working on?
We're always working on lots of stuff, man, working on lots of stuff. We're trying to work on something that would address the fact that when we produce goods in the United States, we take care of air pollution. When they make those same goods in, say, China, they don't. That lowers their cost of manufacturing by 20%, makes their goods cheaper on the world market than ours, but they're exporting their pollution to us. We're trying to address that. We think we're getting a lot of support from industry. We think we're getting support from the administration. We'd like to put that fee out there for anybody trying to lower their manufacturing costs to steal our jobs by dumping their pollution on us. Very excited about that because we're getting a lot of support from industry, a lot of support from unions, and it sounds like we're getting support from the administration.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your time. Stay in touch. Senator Bill Cassidy, Senator Dr. Mr. Bill Cassidy, 654, 6 till 7. I sure hope we can get something done with flood insurance rates and President Trump can sign an executive order, because they said Biden could do it. And if Biden can do it, I would think Trump can do it. 6 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Today it's the Oakland Art Jeweler tip line, and I'm getting some tips. I've already shared mine with a package that has a little notch in it that you tear. If you tear it away from you instead of toward you, it'll work perfectly. At least it does for me. Or you can turn a package away from you and then pull it toward you. See what happens. And I'm getting some more tips I'll share after the news. Right now, we're joined by Martha Kegel, President Martha
Executive
Kegel,
Director.
President and CEO of Jefferson. What the hell am I doing here? Help me out.
Okay, I am the executive director of Unity of Greater New Orleans. We're a nonprofit that leads a collaborative of organizations working together to end homelessness by providing housing and services.
Might be time to clean my glasses because I'm reading like five different lines at the same time. All right, let's talk about what's going on in the legislature and what it is that has made its way through a committee, I guess, about homelessness and encampments, et cetera.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we're seeing a bunch of bills being introduced this session to criminalize homelessness. And the first of them passed a Senate committee on Tuesday, It's Senate Bill 196, and it's expected to go to a vote of the full Senate next week. And it really, you know, it's criminalizing homelessness. It accomplishes absolutely nothing positive. It's costing the taxpayers a lot of money. It's cruelty toward the poor. And it omits the reason why there is so much homelessness, which is because housing is unaffordable. In New Orleans, for example, a quarter of our population, rather, is below the poverty line. And minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, which hasn't changed in more than a decade. And the fair market rent right now for a one-bedroom apartment is $1,236 a month. There is no way that a person making minimum wage, which many people do, or $8 an hour, which many people do, or even $10 an hour or $15 an hour could afford a one-bedroom apartment. So people are becoming homeless every day who are our neighbors and friends and family members who were not homeless the night before. And, you know, we need to do something about that, not wasting money throwing people in jail. And this bill actually would make homelessness a felony.
So I looked it up, and on average it costs about, and look, forget the moral part of this, forget the constitutional part of this, forget all of that.
Right.
I'm just looking at the bottom line here. It costs about $25,000 a year to house a prisoner. So I think what people need to remember is if this happens, you would be taking people off of the street and in essence housing them in prison at the cost of $25,000 per person, just bottom line financially, correct?
And that's just the jail time. That's not counting the police time, distracting the police from actually, you know, dealing with violent crime, which is what should be the priority. It's not counting the cost to the court system. That's just counting the jail time. So it is just a terrible waste of taxpayer money, and it's cruelty toward the poor, which is why the Louisiana bishops have joined together to oppose these bills, and so has the Louisiana Interchurch Conference, which represents, you know, all of the denominations. It's really a violation of everything, every religious tradition. I mean, Jesus said, whatever ye do to the least of these, my brethren, you do it unto me. All the faith traditions, all ethical traditions call for taking care of the vulnerable, taking care of the poor. And so these bills really violate everything that we're supposed to stand for.
So let me quote from a story here by Sophie Kasico from NOLA.com. Under Senate Bill 196, authored by State Senator Robert Owen, Republican from Slidell, camping on public property would be a felony on the second conviction. Says it would the bill would also allow judges to create court programs dedicated to homelessness cases, which could aim to put defendants through drug and mental health programs instead of sending them to prison. The bill, they say, was intended to address mental illness and drug addiction among homeless people. We put a lot of these people in housing, but because of these problems, mental illness, drug addiction, a lot of times they don't want to stay in these places because there's rules and they're right, not in the right state of mind to follow any kinds of rules. But critics are saying that there's no funding for additional mental health or drug treatment programs. So it seems, and also once you have a criminal conviction, it might be harder to get off the streets and get into a job. You can address all of that when we come back and talk about the numbers and what actual statistics show, because it's one thing to see homeless people and to presume one thing, but for somebody like Martha Cagle that deals with it every day, it's something different. Executive Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans will continue the conversation when we come back. 7:21 now, traffic, WWL. 7:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Martha Cagle, Executive Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans, talking about this SB 196 that's making its way through the legislature that would make camping on public property a felony on the second conviction. And some of the things that they said, just to recap for the audience, Martha, before I turn it over to you, a lot of these people in housing, but because of these problems, mental illness, drug addiction, a lot of times they don't want to stay in these places because there's rules and they're not in the right state of mind to follow any rules. Does that, is that the truth or not from what you've seen, et cetera?
Well, it completely omits the fact that the primary cause of rising homelessness is the shortage of affordable rental housing. And you can just Google Bipartisan Policy Center, which is a very respected national policy center, which is both Republican and Democrat, and they're looking at the research. And overwhelmingly, all the research shows that the major cause of homelessness, of high rates of homelessness in one city compared to another, is the degree to which there's a shortage of affordable rental housing. As I explained, you know, we have that problem very severely in Louisiana, particularly in the New Orleans area, where a one-bedroom apartment is $1,236 a month, and a lot of people are making $7.25 an hour minimum wage, or maybe $8, $9, or $10 an hour, cannot afford those kinds of rents. So that's the major problem, and these bills are totally overlooking that. When it comes to who, if there's a shortage of affordable rental housing, as there is here, who is disproportionately affected? Well, yes. Who is disproportionately affected does tend to be people with disabilities. It does tend to be people who encounter discrimination, black people, for example. It does tend to be elderly people. It does tend to be very young families who are very poor. Disability does play a big factor, especially in terms of who is on the street. And the problem with this bill, as has been pointed out by numerous advocates, is that it doesn't provide any additional funding to actually make psychiatric care more available. It is very hard to access in Louisiana because it's so poorly funded. You might have to wait quite a while for an appointment when you're in crisis. Oftentimes, even if you meet the criteria for being hospitalized, you can't get hospitalized. You might be a danger to yourself or others, and you still can't get hospitalized. And when you are hospitalized, typically you're only hospitalized for 3 days, and that's not enough time to accomplish anything to stabilize your mental health condition. This bill is not addressing the actual problem in any way that would actually make things better.
So, in your opinion, if this passes as it stands now, what would the consequences be and what would it look like?
The consequences would be that the taxpayers would be paying a whole lot of money to criminalize homelessness, to divert police away from dealing with violent crime instead making them spend their time arresting homeless people. Nothing would be accomplished by throwing them in jail. They would return to the streets in a worse position than they were before they got in jail, because a lot of people have jobs. They would have lost their jobs. A lot of people will lose their ID when they're in jail. A lot of people will lose contact with their case managers who are trying to help them get into housing and get into mental health treatment and substance use treatment. And nothing will have been accomplished except raiding the taxpayers' pocketbook.
One other thought I had I wanted to ask you about is percentage of veterans that comprise the homeless. Do you have a percentage of that, or what percentage of veterans are homeless, or what percentage of the homeless are veterans?
You know, we're doing a really good job. We're considered, you know, a national leader in this in terms of prioritizing veterans. And, there are specific resources for veterans that are much more generously funded than for other populations. We still have some veterans who are homeless, but we do a really good job of getting them housed as quickly as possible. When a veteran refuses housing, and sometimes that does happen, then we continue to work with them and try to persuade them to accept housing. But we do have a problem in that it's very difficult for those relatively few people who really need hospitalization, or they even need something called assisted outpatient treatment, where they are medicated there's not enough resources for those things. So even the people who need, you know, the more dramatic solutions like hospitalization or assisted outpatient treatment can't get access to that. And people who voluntarily want to be treated can't get access to those things when they need them.
Thank you, Martha. Appreciate your time. Martha Cagle, Executive Director, Unity of Greater New Orleans. And things have consequences one way or the other. 7:30, take a break, come back. Time now, WWO First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. It's 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quick note, next hour, we're going to talk to a juror who sat on the Hannah Landon trial as a jury, in the death of six-year-old Bella Fontenelle. We'll talk to him in the next hour. Right now, it's time to help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. How you doing, Mark?
Good morning, sir, and happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you as well. What are we talking about today?
Absolutely. Well, Tommy, first of all, it was something we'll carry over till Monday. But, you know, we had a first quarter GDP registered a negative number. That news was disseminated earlier in the week. And we just got news of the job report that's kind of weak. So, you know, we really need to be paying attention to what our investments are. We need to do it anyway. But when the economy is coming down, then the conversations start about 401ks becoming 301ks and 201ks. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we're just in that part of the economy right now where we might have to sit up straight a little bit more. But I was looking at an article that came out in April by Larry Fink. And the people that don't know who that is, he's the CEO of an investment firm called BlackRock. It's the largest financial institution in the world. About $10 trillion in assets are managed within that company. And before we, you know, it's like we might be taking advantage of a 401k or other investment product someplace else. And a lot of times it ends up at BlackRock because they're managing just trillions of dollars of investment money through 401k plans and so on. So when he comes out to speak, it's, you know, it's interesting to see what his perspectives are and what he thinks about the economy and so on. Within the article, he was challenging an age-old investment mix where people would say, you get a lot of financial advisors to say in general, it doesn't work for everybody. It's not for everybody. But in general, it's why don't you go through life with a 60-40 mix of stocks and bonds? There's a lot of benefit to that. You get more on the equity markets than the debt markets because the equity markets are typically going up faster and have a better performance than debt. But the debt markets will add some stability and less volatility to a portfolio. So that's been out for forever. And Larry comes out and says, you know, fast forward, I want to challenge that. And maybe we need to look at something a little bit differently because it adds a little bit more diversification. It adds a little bit more stability. And it could easily add more income than you would previously get in the 60-40 mix. So he proposed a 50-30-20. He said, go 50% in stocks instead of 60, 30% in fixed income instead of 40. And that other 20% that you've pulled out of that initial equation, he said, put 20% in private investments. Well, that's easier said than done. When he's managing trillions of dollars, they can do things like that. But for the average investor, it's like, well, I can't invest in a road, for instance, that throws off a lot of money in tolls. And that's what he means by private investment. So then what are we talking about? But the idea of a real estate investment trust, or REIT, R-E-I-T is the acronym, that you can do, and people will gain the plus on a REIT is that it accumulates money from many investors like us, and then it would go out and buy real estate. It might be commercial real estate, it might be a subdivision, it might be a medical properties, it might be other commercial properties, and they take our investment money, invest in those properties. The idea is that once a building is built, it could be a strip mall. And the money it throws off from the rents is income to the investor. And the REIT doesn't pay, if it qualifies as a genuine REIT, one of the pluses that's always discussed when that topic comes up is they don't pay income tax if they distribute 90% of their earnings over to the investor. So what people find is when they approach REITs as an investment, you find these relatively large dividends, and it's like, wow, where can I get an 8 or 9 or 10 or sometimes much higher than that? Where can I get a 12% dividend the higher the dividend, the higher the cash flow to an investor. It works kind of like a bond type of investment, but it lowers the volatility. When people normally complain about their 401ks becoming 201ks, well, you're investing in things that might have a more volatile response to any change in the economy. Well, when our dividends get large, and just taking my word for it for a second, when the dividends get large or the payout gets large to the investor, it tempers that volatility. So some people like calm. Well, that a REIT might be an answer to some of that calm in the portfolio. And I'll give people an example. Walgreens leases 85% of their properties. So they own very few. Walgreens all across the country. So a REIT could say, well, we will loan you money to build the property and that we're going to get you to rent it. That rental income comes back to the REIT and, again, is distributed to the investor. You and I can't go in and say, well, we're going to get a piece of Walgreens property leases. That's not going to be possible on a one-on-one basis. But through a REIT is a vehicle that we can participate in that, where otherwise we'd be closed out of that. We just can't walk up as a retail investor and get into those things. So it adds a diversification. Larry Fink said we back-tested that. In many times over long periods of time, 20 to 25 years, the REITs have outperformed the S&P 500 in many cases. What do we have to be worried about? Well, okay, you pick your REIT carefully. One of whatever is, it would be like you sit down with your investment advisor. Do you want like medical properties, meaning a REIT that owns a lot of hospitals? Do you want a Walgreens-type lease? They might own the retail type of establishment that way. It could be oil-type properties. It could be large commercial properties, or it could be residential real estate. So they all have their pluses and minuses, but it's just something to consider, Tom, because it kind of just challenges the wisdom that's been around for a long time. And Fink is saying, well, there's generally stability. We've had times where the real estate market wasn't stable. We've had times that any market wasn't stable. But to put, let's say, a small amount of a traditional portfolio in that direction has added stability, so says Fink, and their back testing has confirmed that.
Very valuable information, Mark. And for people that want to find out more about that kind of thing, how would they do it?
Well, if they have an investment advisor, you could start there. If you want to Google it, like I did this morning, Real Estate Investment Trust, or REIT, a lot of information will come up. And that's where I got that Walgreens information, where they were, you know, they leased the majority of their properties. So that would be a typical REIT investment and with a company that has financial stability. And that would add some income to the portfolio.
Thank you, Mark. Valuable information. Yes, we'll talk to you on Monday. And by the way, I want to mention jeffersonfinancial.org. If you go there, you'll find some very helpful calculators. In the middle of the page, you'll see the tab you click on. No cost, no obligation, no information. All you got to do is use those almost 100 calculators to help you figure out your own personal financial plan. 7:55, 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL. It is 8:15. It took the jury less than an hour, I think, to deliberate to find Bunnock Landon guilty of first-degree murder and death of six-year-old Bella Fontenelle, and that's a child whose body was left in a bucket on her mother's porch. And we always hear about these cases, and we hear about jury duty, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk to Mark Johnson, who was actually on that jury, and get a kind of like anatomy of the trial and how it happened and so forth. So with that, we welcome in Mark Johnson. How are you, sir?
Yes, sir. Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Tell me about, let's start at the beginning here. You get a jury duty notice, I guess, to show up at Jefferson Parish. And at what point did you find out this was going to be the case that you would serve as a juror on?
Yes, that is kind of a little interesting story in and of itself. I did, receive that jury summons to come in for, that would have been Monday of this week. If anyone that has done it before knows, you know, you show up at around, 8:30, they talk a lot to you. There's a lot of sitting and waiting, all day. So I did sit and wait all the way up until it was about 6 p.m. at night. I remember calling my wife and telling her, I think it should be any minute now. I'm going to be, released and able to come home. I started making plans for starting work the next day. And sure enough, bailiffs come in saying we need a panel of jurors right around like 6:15 p.m. at night. So much later than I anticipated, did not think anything would be starting then. But long story short, stayed there till about 9:30, something like that, and it all happened very quickly, and suddenly I was on a jury. They said, you need to show back up tomorrow morning for 8:45, and we're going to get going.
You had to have heard about this case, right?
Yes, sir. I actually honestly was reminded of it that morning on my drive to jury duty via WWL radio. So that was something.
Wait, say that again?
I was reminded of the trial on my drive to, not the trial, of the case. On my way to jury duty, there was, I believe, some mention of it on WWL on this morning show as I was driving over there, and I said, oh, I haven't heard of that case in a while. You know, I wonder what's going to happen with that.
So how could I'm sorry, Mark. How could you?
Yes, sir.
I'm sure during the voir dire process, they asked you if you had made up your mind. The woman was on video with a bucket. Mm-hmm. Was there no doubt that she did it? The only question was whether she was insane or not. What was it that they told you to decide or to judge?
Yes, sir. That ultimately was what was actually on trial here. I think it became, obviously even with video evidence, there needs to be due process. There needs to be an impartial jury that is made up of people that ideally have as much of a blank slate as possible to come in and, hear the facts. Because, yes, video evidence like that is, I would say, pretty damning, but it's something that still just needs to be done correctly. So, yes, they were very clear and careful in that voir dire process of saying, hey, look, I know this has already had a lot of attention. I'm sure everyone here has heard at least a little bit, if not a lot, about this case already. But we need, to do this right, we need 12 people, that are going to be as fair and impartial as possible and who can be patient and sit through all the facts and go over everything and make sure this is done right.
I've had jury duty a couple of times, Mark, and one thing that always slaps me in the face is that it's an abstract concept until the responsibility is yours and you realize, okay, I got to decide if, in fact, this person goes to jail for the rest of their life or not. Did you have an open mind going into this? I presume you did, and as you listened to the facts as they were being presented, were the facts more about whether or not she was insane at the time, or was it about what she did?
That's right. So, I think it was the trial begun with more about just confirming what she did. The state's case, the prosecutors that did, I need to give them a shout out too. I've already been telling people that both the assistant district attorneys, Lindsay Truey and Rachel Affrick, did just a phenomenal job of making it, I would say, blatantly and obviously clear that the only reasonable, story here is that she committed this murder. And then once that became clear, the defense was really about, okay, well, was she, legally sane or insane during that time when she committed that act? And that's really what the trial shifted towards, is determining her state of mind, her legal sanity or insanity.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll get back. We're talking to Mark Johnson, who was on the jury that convicted the murderer of that six-year-old Bella Fontenelle, the body was in a bucket and carried to her mother's house, and it was on in a wagon or whatever. It was on numerous video doorbell cameras captured. We'll continue to talk about the process when we come back. The death penalty, I don't think, was ever on a table. She is convicted of first-degree murder and will spend the rest of her life in jail, and rightfully so. 821 traffic now, WWL. 825 now, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mark Johnson, who served on the jury that convicted Bunak Landon in a first-degree murder and death of six-year-old Bella Fontenelle. I don't want to get into any of the graphic details at all, Mark, and I just would ask you, though, and I understand that you're a parent, and this goes to the nature of being on a juror and jury duty. It has to be hard to unsee some of the things that you saw during the trial.
That's right. To have that due process, they need to show everything, right? No stone left unturned. And so we were, not only us, but whoever was attending the trial, which included, family members and, just people very close to Bella, just had to look at unless they turned away or shut their eyes. There were, yes, I won't go into any detail, but there were, I'm sure you can imagine, some photos, autopsy photos, things like that, that, yes, I know I'll never forget.
Was there anything that at any point made you think she might have been insane, or was it pretty much a weak case that the defense put up to begin with?
I mean, there was a defense. I mean, there was enough to bring it to trial, right? So, mm-hmm. But ultimately, I mean, if you're talking about the strength of the defense, I mean, we just to give you the clues with us. I mean, we deliberated, like they reported, under an hour. Not only did we come out with that, our, you know, decision as a whole, but we were polled each individually, and that took no time at all. And it was very clear there was a unanimous decision between 12 people that, yes, that the prosecution got this right. She was, you know, that defense of not guilty by reason of insanity did not hold up.
They didn't, the Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office didn't go for the death penalty, although it is first-degree murder and there was extenuating circumstances. This is just speculation, but do you know if, do you have any idea if the jury would have voted for the death penalty or not? And look, this is a completely, this is just hypothetical on your part. This has no factual basis or anything. I'm just wondering about your thoughts on that.
That because it wasn't even on the table as an option. I mean, there was no discussion. So mm-hmm. I really wouldn't be able to speak in terms of, I didn't even ask or we did not discuss as far as each of us where what our beliefs were on the death penalty or anything like that. That wasn't even it's not, you know, the duty of the jury to find to sentence, but the only thing that we were told is that if we find the defendant guilty with first degree murder, that with mm-hmm. Louisiana law comes with this mandatory life in prison without parole, without a couple different options that were sometimes available. But no, we did not discuss the death penalty at all.
How would that have changed? How has this whole thing changed your life, Mark, if I can ask?
Well, you asked if I'm a parent. I mean, mm-hmm. I have three young children, right? So basically 4-year-old, 2-year-old, and a 4.5-month-old, almost 5-month-old. And it definitely is one of those moments where you realize, you know, how fragile life can be and how quickly things can turn around. And it makes you really love and appreciate your children, and also just love and appreciate the justice system in general, that it can, you know, handle such an act and atrocity and get things right and have justice served.
When it came time for you to actually say guilty, because again, that's real. This is not hypothetical. This is not an abstract situation. You're saying, yes, this person deserves to go to jail for the rest of their life. Was there any pause at all, or did you just, or were you convinced that she knew what she was doing at the time?
Well, I think we were convinced. It didn't take very long for us to reach that conviction, but there was a pause in terms of, you know, we actually said a prayer back there in the room. We actually chose a foreman that was not only our leader with the jury, but also just happened to be, I'm sure this was divine intervention, but a spiritual leader as well. Our foreman actually got out a Bible from his bag, and we said, hey, can we just pause and, yes, take this pause to appreciate the seriousness of what we are about to do, and let's say a prayer and make sure everyone has said their piece, and let's get this right. So there definitely was a pause, and there was an appreciation for, you know, taking this seriously and understanding really the implications of what's going to happen once we write down something on this piece of paper.
Mark, thanks for taking the time and sharing your thoughts with us, because I know it wasn't easy, and that just goes to the importance of why you shouldn't try to get out of jury duty. It is all our responsibility to do so. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. All right, 8:30, we'll take a break. We come back, we're going to talk about temperatures heating up, more bugs that could bug your pets. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we'll go to Dave Cohen. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It always amazes me, ever since I was a kid, listening to the radio, how out of nowhere an Almond Joy commercial would pop up. And it just happened. I don't know why that is, or I don't know the reasons for it, but It's just an observation. Another observation is that we're into the heat and humidity. It's May 2nd here, and that means flea and tick season for dogs and cats and all the lovable pets that we have. Dr. Gary Levy joins us now, veterinarian with Lakeview Veterinary Hospital. Talk about it. How you doing, Dr. Levy?
I'm well, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I am okay. I got a dog, Teddy, that, you know, they got these, have you, as a veterinarian, this is off the topic, but have you ever found a toy to truly be indestructible that wasn't made of steel?
No, definitely not.
They stuff them, and then they rip the stuffing up out, and it looks like the pig, for example, that Teddy recently destroyed, looks like he had too much Wegovy, or too much whatever you call that stuff, because they got all the sag and skin all over, nothing on the inside, you know? Let's talk about fleas and ticks and what people need to be aware of.
You bet. I mean, we got spoiled with this beautiful, mild April, but as soon as these 80s and the heat and humidity hit in May, the fleas will be coming back with a vengeance, for sure. So, I mean, you need to try and get ahead of it and make sure they're on a preventative, you know. And probably the best one that we've been using for dogs has been an oral 3-month tablets called Brevecto. That seems to be the one that's been the most resistant to having breakthrough flea problems. So cats have a similar one. It's a 3-month topical for them, and hopefully we're by the end of this year, they're promising us that one perhaps in a year-long injectable, which would be nice, because that's the way we've gone with the heartworm preventatives, which are nice.
Yeah, let's talk about mosquitoes and heartworms as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, fleas are a nuisance, heartworms are deadly. So, yeah, I mean, the arrival of a 6 or 12-month injection to prevent heartworms has been a life-changer, you know, for the dogs especially. I mean, because we, the humans, are bad about remembering to do it, whether it was daily in the old days or even monthly. You know, the biggest reason dogs get heartworms is they're not on preventative, or we're not giving it the way it's prescribed, which is once a month. The standard one. So the injectable versions are the way to go with that, because mosquitoes are the way that's transmitted. And even if your dog is predominantly inside, you know, how many of us have never seen mosquitoes inside? So yeah, stay on that. But the fleas, go ahead.
No, I just want to open a text line here at 504-260-1870 if anybody has any questions or comments about flea protection of their pets or ticks, etc. But finish your thought, Gary, please.
No, just that staying ahead of it is much easier than by the time you've got a flea infestation. The creatures are incredible. I mean, you know, each female flea can lay 50 eggs a day. So it doesn't take long before you're totally behind the eight ball and trying to, you know, so be aware of outdoor, you know, surroundings too. I mean, fleas hate direct sunlight. So, you know, you're not going to get them on the levee where there's no trees, things like that. It's going to be shadier, moist areas, things like that, especially around your house. Raised houses here, horrible. You know, if you've got a problem with other wildlife outside, including stray cats and raccoons and possums, things like that, the squirrels get a bad rap. They don't carry fleas, so don't worry about the squirrels. But, you know, make sure you, if you've got a problem, not only treat the pet, but you may have to treat the environment as well. And the best one I like there is a granule. You can get at the big box stores called Over and Out. The active chemical ingredient is bifenthrin, and it's an easy one to spread out like you would weed and feed, and you just do it twice a year, and it does. You'll find it's mostly labeled as a fire ant protector, but it does fire ants, it does fleas, it does termites. Really easy and safe to get ahead of that.
I'm getting a couple of texts here. We'll pass them along to Dr. Gary Levy. When we come back, we're talking about flea and tick season and your dogs and cats and how to keep them safe. And the Oakland Art Jeweler text line is open at 504-260-1870 if you got any questions. Somebody texted in, this is a pretty good question. How does the medicine work once it's inside the dog or the cat? Because does it mean when the fleas bite the dog or cat, do they die, and or do they not want to be attracted to the dog or cat? We'll find out. We come back 8:51, 9 till 9. Traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9. Couple of minutes left. Tommy Tucker, WWR, with Dr. Gary Levy, veterinarian with Lakeview Veterinary Hospital. We're talking about heartworms and fleas and ticks. And, Doctor, somebody texted it in, and I've always wondered that myself. The injectable, not the injectable, I guess the medicine that the dogs or cats eat, does that change their blood or something? Do the fleas bite the dog and then they die, or does it make the dogs not attractive to, or cats to the fleas? How does that work?
No, it is the blood meal that the flea takes that poisons the flea, you know, but it's a safe enough product that it's very specific towards the flea's nervous system that it doesn't adversely affect the dogs and the cats. So they do have to bite them to die, but then very quickly, dead fleas don't lay eggs. So that's how you quickly get control of the population.
So is there a combination, somebody wants to know, heartworm and flea medicine that you can get?
There are. I mean, the standards in those, there are several now that you give monthly that will cover preventing heartworms, fleas and ticks, as well as intestinal parasites. So, yeah, again, the key with that is you got to be good and vigilant about remembering to do that monthly, because if you miss a dose, you know, down here, you're going to get in trouble sooner than later.
I know they used to do this stuff where you would rub it on the neck of the pet. Do they still have those, and do you recommend that or not?
They still have those. I mean, we've found that the systemic, the ones they take orally or injectably, are, you know, there's, you don't have to worry about lack of absorption. You don't have to worry about putting it on and 10 minutes later they're outside and they're jumping in the pool, or they get rained on, and have they absorbed enough to be effective, you know. And then you gotta keep them away from being touched or rubbing against furniture for a few minutes too. So yeah, the trend is certainly moving toward the oral and injectable ones as opposed to relying on the topical ones. If you think back, you know, decades ago when we were spraying and dipping and bathing, and that has totally become, you know, ineffective for the most part in controlling fleas. So a lot of the topicals are less effective as well.
Real quick, just 40 seconds left. Does the same medicine prevent ticks as fleas, or is that a different thing?
No, it does. Most of the ones out there are going to do both fleas and ticks. And ticks are, you know, I tell people you either always have ticks or you never have ticks. Or if, you know, if you go a different place out in the country, you might be exposed to it. But it's not like fleas where they can come out of nowhere because somebody moves in next door and you've got a number of new, now untreated pets, you know, up against your fence.
Thank you, Doc. Appreciate your time as always. And if you miss the flea prevention, just get on top of it, right?
You bet. Take care, Tommy. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Dr. Gary Levy, veterinarian with Lakeview Veterinary Hospital. We love our little furry friends. We also love Ian McNulty, who's coming up next. Talk about eating and drinking. Then in the second half of the hour, we're going to talk to Tyler Shucks, high school head coach. Get the background on that young man. A lot coming up. Stay with us. Well, I hope you have a great weekend, whatever it is. And me? Oh, all kinds of things. Far too many to even start talking about. Yeah, pretty much. That's right. Cutting the grass, and that's about it. And playing with Teddy the dog. And I don't know if you heard what I told the doctor before, but, you know, they rip the stuffing out of these dogs and out of these toys. And maybe it's a pig or maybe it's a duck or whatever it is. And then it winds up looking like somebody had had too much weight loss medicine because it's just skin and there's nothing there. It's just sagging skin. Thank you, Dave. Ian McNulty joins us now. Pardon me?
What an intro. That's great.
Yeah. No, but it's true. That's what it looks like. That's the only thing I thought of is I'm holding what used to be ducky or piggy. It's just skin. It's like, wow, you had a little bit too much of that weight loss drug. Well, where is Ian
Go ahead. I am here to inflate you, my friends. I am here to pump back up with good food stuff. Tons of good food stuff to talk about this week, Tommy. We've got a new French bistro downtown, taking over a very well-known restaurant spot in the Warehouse District. We've got a Metairie po' boy shop hitting a major milestone birthday this week. Sadly, we have the last days for two really terrific restaurants coming up this weekend. And we've got Jazz Fest Part Deux with lots of great food out there, including my own creative Jazz Fest DIY food mashups. Where do you want to begin on that menu?
I would start with Jazz Fest and the part deux.
That's right. This is Act Two for Jazz Fest, the second weekend. And, you know, people ask me, like, what I'm excited about or who I saw at a Jazz Fest. And the first weekend, it's all food names. It's all crawfish Monica, crawfish bread, Vaucresson po' boy. You get the picture. It's all food for me. I've been slicing and dicing. I've got many stories up on NOLA.com right now and my Instagram feed is just a cornucopia of the culinary from out there at Jazz Fest. So if you're craving sweets, savory, snacks, what's new, what's classic, check out NOLA.com or Ian McNulty NOLA, and you can get a glimpse of that. But my latest endeavor is my DIY mashups. And in the spirit of improv, in the spirit of, oh, I don't know, Irma Thomas wandering on stage with the Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. sometimes I use a little improv out there. Sometimes I mash up my own little jam session. And
that's a nice memory you brought up just now. You know that?
Irma and Rolling Stones?
Yeah, especially considering that she did the song Time Is On My Side first, and the Stones covered her version.
Look, those guys are all getting up there. I'm so glad they finally had the opportunity to play with real royalty, with the Rolling Stones all the way out here, and have the opportunity to meet Irma Thomas. I thought that was really special. Guys,
I'm glad you brought that up. Now let's talk about your mashups.
Yes, okay. So the classic one is this, and you can follow along if you like, Picture Pages style on Instagram right now, because the first one's up there. I was holding a bag of crackling, and I thought, wow, this is really good. I love crackling at Jazz Fest. I really love that Cochon de Lait po' boy. You know, in the spirit of what the winemakers say, what grows together goes together. You know, pair the wines of the region with the food of the region. And what if I combine this crackling with this Cochon de Lait, this roasted pork, this Cajun-style roasted pork, and thus a monster was born, Tommy. It is a Cochon de Lait po' boy studded with crunchy wonks of fried crackling. And it's a little ridiculous. It's very much over the top. But in the spirit of Jazz Fest, dang, it's a lot of fun, and it's decadent, and it's definitely something you want to split with people because it's really heavy.
So you take the cracklings and you put them on the Cochon de Lait po' boy, and
correct.
It's a different taste sensation and textures and everything else.
Exactly right. And the crackling was the start of this. It was 1 year at Jazz Fest, there were almost no new dishes to try. There were exactly two. One was a brownie. Okay, so there was really not a lot going on with new food out there. And new food is one of the things that I cover at Jazz Fest. So I had to get creative. And, I followed my muse. And the muse took me by the hand and led me to the crackling stand. And I basically started applying crackling to anything that would hold still long enough to take it. And not all the experiments were good. You know, I thought, crackling on a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Bacon and peanut butter. It's kind of an intuitive pairing. No, does not work. The bread is too weak for the crackling. It just turns into a sticky mess.
Mm-hmm.
But, Tommy, you take that same crackling and you put it in the Prejean's gumbo, that dark rue gumbo. And hat tip to Stanton Moore for this one, the drummer for Galactic. He's the one who showed me this one. And suddenly, your gumbo has andouille, quail, pheasant, and basically meaty, crisp skinned pork croutons with that roux all clung to it. Delicious and fun. And every time I talk about this with people, they have their own riffs. So I'm not claiming to be the Willy Wonka inventor of all this stuff. I'm sharing the joy with people and bringing hopefully the light of heavy food and heavy times to show like what fun it can be to go on a food romp at this big festival that we celebrate every year.
But you know what? Hang on 1 second, because I want to open that Open Heart Jeweler talking text line to mashups that people have made on their own. And it doesn't have to be Jazz Fest food, just things that you've decided to mash up like Ian McNulty did with the cracklins and the Cochon de Lait po' boy, but just maybe stuff you eat every day that you've decided to mash up that people would not think of eating together, but they do. I think you've just struck a vein of gold, Ian McNulty.
Let me give you another one. So sometimes they're obvious. Sometimes they're right in front of you, right? So that same gumbo, that Prejean's gumbo at Jazz Fest, Food Area 2, right next door is Mrs. Wheat's meat pies. Mm-hmm. You take that meat pie and you dunk it in the gumbo, and it's like a Cajun French dip, Tommy. Especially after that first bite, once you open up that meat pie, roux is getting in there, mixing with the flaky crust, with the meat within. Delicious. It's almost like birria tacos. So yeah, it's like Creole birria tacos, but it's a meat pie. Here's another one. This one's pretty decadent, okay? But again, right next door to each other. Mm-hmm. The soft-shell crab po' boy from Galley Seafood. This is at Jazz Fest. Go take that, then go next door to the Agent Cajun stand. where they have a crab stick and cucumber salad with tobiko, the little fish roe. This is like you put that salad on top of the soft-shell crab po' boy, and it is like a New Orleans soft-shell crab po' boy took a trip to the sushi bar. Or, like, you just went to Sider Seafood in Harahan, because Jason Sider does a lot of stuff like this, too. Mm-hmm. And then you take some of the sambal alec sauce that they have at the Asian Cajun stand, and you give a few squirts over that, and it's perfection. It looks really cool, too. You can see it on NOLA.com, the model that I threw together. It's that fried soft-shell crab, but the bright notes of the, crab stick. Not really crab, is it? Seafood product. With a cucumber and a little pop of that fish roe, and then that bright red earthy chili sauce on there just to give it a zap. Fantastic. And you're going to walk around with this thing, and I'm telling you, 20 people are going to ask you, what is that? Where did you get it? You say, I made it. It's a DIY Jazz Fest food mashup.
I'm just thinking about, you know, your job and
yes, this is a job.
The fact that you have nothing else to do than think of mashing up Jazz Fest foods together. And you do it successfully. You do it very well. I'm just thinking, you know, digging a ditch, somebody else, running cables.
First of all, I have been a ditch digger in the past. I have experience with that. I know that the job I have now does beat digging ditches, so I can say that with authority. But this is not the only thing I do. I multitask like nobody's business, because whilst doing all this, you can go to NOLA.com and see the news of Paran Po' Boys.
Hang on a second. I want to get to one more mashup. I want to do the Boudin Ball grilled cheese mashup, because that looks pretty good to me.
Yeah, this is a great one, and it's the cheapest of the bunch. I mean, that soft-shell crab po' boy runs pretty high this year, so, you know, you're throwing some money at this experiment. But this one is simple. You go to the Boudin stand, Food Area 1. You get the Boudin balls. I think it's like $7. You get 3 Boudin balls. Just eat one right away on its own because they're delicious. Mm-hmm. And while you're eating that, walk over to the Joyce's Lemonade stand. Most people are in line there for the lemonade, but they also make a grilled cheese sandwich. This used to be over in the kids' area. So, you know, grilled cheese sandwich for the kids. You order a grilled cheese sandwich, white bread, American cheese. That's the way to go. You peel it open, like lifting the lid of a car. You take one of the Boudin balls. You mash it in there. You mash it down so it spreads across the sandwich. You put the other half of the bread back down. You've got a butter crisp grilled cheese sandwich Boudin ball mashup that they'd be proud to serve you at any gas station butcher shop in Acadiana, I promise you. And that sandwich is like $5. The Boudin balls are 7, but you get 3 of them. So you can do this several times if you're with some friends out there. And it's fantastic. And it's fun. And it's delicious. And it's the spirit of Jazz Fest, just to make your own little traditions and rituals and fun little riffs out there to make the mega event your own.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Some of the smash-ups that are coming in are mash-ups on the text line. Cracklin' and mixed them in Creole potato salad. Excellent. Somebody else said they eat peanut butter and cold ketchup together. Which is
weird.
Interesting. That's kind of strange. And somebody else said they make banana pudding with mayonnaise, which doesn't sound particularly good to me. But, hey, to each his own. If y'all got a mashup that you do, we'd love to hear from them. 504-260-1870. Somebody else says smash a Boudin ball on a nice homemade biscuit and drizzle it with Tabasco pepper jelly. Now, that could work. Because, again, you know, you're talking about chicken and waffles. That's a mashup, right? That's one thing that you wouldn't think necessarily would go together. It works perfectly. Ian McNulty's our guest. We're talking eating and drinking. You're welcome to be part of the conversation, 504-260-1870. We'll talk about some restaurants and outside of Jazz Fest food when we come back on WWL. About 6 minutes left with Ian McNulty, and then we're going to talk to Tyler Shucks, high school coach, and get some background on the newest Saints quarterback. Let's talk about the Paran's Po' Boys and some other places that you wrote about, Ian.
Yeah, that's right. That's the one of the ones I mentioned for the break. Paran's is one of those old school po' boy shops. You just go in and it just feels eternal. Well, it comes by that vibe naturally. It opened in 1975, so it's been around for 50 years. And this week they're celebrating that.
It's hard to believe.
Sorry?
50 years. That's hard to believe. That's a long time.
Right? Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. The current owners, the Hornbrooks, Al and Laurel, they took over in the 90s, and they really kicked it into a new gear, expanded it, later on added the second location out in Kenner. They had a third one uptown on Britannia Street that lasted a few years, closed a couple years back, kind of pandemic thing. But the anchor of it all is the same as it ever was. It's just classic Pro Boys. They expanded the menu quite a bit. The seafood muffalata there is a classic. You know, it's the kind of place where plate lunches still reside, like a melaton casserole, that kind of thing. But the bread and butter is roast beef po' boys, fried shrimp po' boys, meatball po' boys, that kind of thing. And so this week they're doing a special in there. You can get the details, you know, from the shop. But it's a good deal on a couple, kind of a two po' boy combo kind of deal for, it continues until tomorrow. But congrats to them, you know, because it's tough out there for restaurants. We've seen a couple really special ones in New Orleans are shutting down this weekend. So for a place like Paran's to make it 50 years, you know, hats off to them. And that's the kind of longevity that I love to see in the restaurant scene. The two that are closing are related. MoFo in Mid-City. Mm-hmm. So anytime casual spot with just really creative, interesting cuisine based on Southeast Asian flavors. Not a Vietnamese restaurant, but kind of taking those flavors and really creating an original cuisine out of it, but keeping it casual and approachable. And then its upscale counterpart downtown, Maypop. Now, Maypop was right across the street from that building that collapsed in December, the building that houses Louisiana Endowment for Humanities and other offices, an old historic building right in the middle of the CBD. It collapses basically right across the street from Maypop and throws a restaurant that was, frankly, you know, trying to make the turn, trying to be financially viable through the pandemic and all that. And, you know, you put a collapsed building on its doorstep, and then, I don't know if you've been down there lately, but that block, while it's open to traffic, it is barely open to traffic. All these months later, there's still barricades all over the place. It's hard to park. It looks like a contested border crossing. Not a great situation down there. And that, I'm told by the chef, was the nail in the coffin for Maypop. MoFo, just, you know, declining business. And there's the rub, Tommy, because I posted the news about these places closing, and for MoFo in particular, people couldn't believe it. They were in my ear constantly. I was at a jazz fest. All people wanted to do was talk about MoFo closing because it was a favorite place. It was a very popular restaurant, but popular isn't always the same thing as busy when it's time to pay the bills. So the moral of the story here is, you know, if there's a place that you love, your visit will not go unappreciated, especially when summer sets in. And that was the cue for the owners, the chef owners there. They were like, listen, summer's coming up. We see the numbers. We just can't do it. We're not going to be able to make it through summer and then, you know, hope for the rebound in the fall, which is what almost all restaurants do in this town. And it's a bad situation that's getting worse with the higher costs. Insurance being a huge one of them. Please, somebody in a position of power, please put your attention on that instead of all this other nonsense. It really would help out your constituents everywhere a whole lot, including us restaurant lovers. So, you know, farewell to MoFo and Maypop. You've got a couple more days. They're both closing on Sunday for the last hurrah. But we needn't leave it on that. I know time's running short. There's a great new restaurant you can check out downtown also. Tommy's Cuisine was around for 20 years on Chapultepec Street, right by Emerald's restaurant. They closed late last year. As some new guys took over, and they just opened a couple weeks ago. It's called Lemoyne Bistro, as in Lemoyne, the founder of Colonial New Orleans. And it's French, and it's lovely, and it's a really nice reinvigoration of a place that a lot of people have been into over the years at Chapultepec and Julia. Upscale, real fresh take on French flavors. Not messing around with it too much, but just giving it a lift off of the standard template. And first look at it was very impressive. These are the same guys who have the restaurant Plates around the corner. Mm-hmm. And it's connected to a wine and oyster bar called Maria's that used to be Tommy's Wine Bar. And it literally is connected. You can walk from one to the other. So that's a cool new addition for downtown.
So give me an example of something that you would eat there.
At Lemoyne, you're getting tuna nichois, which is a big hunk of yellowfin tuna, sliced with boiled egg and some like fresh vegetables around it. You're getting an onion soup, which is so French, I don't have to call it French onion soup. You're getting a steak tartare shot through a little chili oil. And you're getting a beef short rib carbonade, which is sort of like a bœuf bourguignon of French chef fame. But imagine that same dish cooked in Belgium, in beer country instead of in wine country. And you've got the beef short rib carbonide. You can see a picture of it on my Instagram at Ian McNulty Nola, and you can see how that beef just flakes apart in a really dark, rich gravy. Just really good, classic continental cooking, just elevated a little bit with a local eye from some New Orleans guys, a lot of whom came out of the Link Restaurant Group, that constant hit maker. And so, you know, people who came up to that group are now spreading their wings at a lot of different restaurants, and Lemoyne Bistro is another good example of that.
I have a highly refined palate. I like steak tartare, but only if it's well done. Somebody texted in some mashups, jambalaya and mashed potatoes, a lot of starches there. Somebody said boiled shrimp cut up and baked into cornbread.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's this hot fudge nachos.
Okay, that's strange.
That is strange.
My palate around it here, Tommy. I'm getting that chocolate, and I like sea salt on my chocolate, you know, mm-hmm. and then just a rich hot fudge sauce.
So is it really that different?
Try something like that.
I'm going to give you 60 seconds left. Give me some Jazz Fest desserts quickly.
Ah, okay. If we're talking chocolate, it's going to be a little hot out there. Go to the gelato booth. It's over by the Gentilly stage. The chocolate Azteca, deeply rich and got a little flicker of heat to it. Tiala's, it's a new booth. Back for their second year. They got a bananas Foster's cheesecake. All these pictures are on my Instagram, by the way. It's really, really good. That bread pudding with white chocolate sauce from Kaluta's. They're best known for their king cakes throughout the year, but they make that crawfish strudel out there, which is not a dessert. I bet that bread pudding is absolutely terrific. And our oysters dessert, I don't know, Tommy, but I got to give them another plug. Every day I've been out there, I've been starting with at least a half dozen oysters from the Lady Nelly stand. They're doing the off-bottom oysters that are growing in the waters near Grand Isle, but they're the elevated, beautiful, refined kind, tad more expensive. But, man, if you just want that fresh pop of a really refined oyster, out there at Jazz Fest, I mean, don't walk away with them. Just go to the stand, get some oysters, pop them down. You can recycle the shells on the spot. And it's a fabulous new addition to Jazz Fest. Oysters are energy, and those have been my little vitamin pops every morning starting out up there.
A pleasure as always, Ian McNulty. Thank you. And don't forget about the praline-stuffed beignet that just can't be as delicious as it looks. Oh. Thank you, sir. 9:35, 25 till 10. Quick look at traffic. Then we're going to talk to Tyler Shucks, high school coach, and get the background on the Saints' newest quarterback as he was growing up. Right now, traffic, WWL. It is 9:42, 18 till 10. Quick note here. There's been a heck of an earthquake off the coast of Argentina and south of Argentina, and the coast of Chile is at risk of a hazardous tsunami. So we'll watch how that unfolds. It happened about an hour ago. About a week ago, the Saints drafted Tyler Shuck as a quarterback, and we thought it'd be interesting to talk to his high school coach, Dick Banaszewski, to see what kind of young man Tyler Shuck is and what it was like to coach him. Good morning, Coach. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. Tell me about Tyler Shuck. How did you first meet him and interaction with him?
Tyler came into our program as a freshman. He was a baseball player and a football player. And I think, you know, in the beginning, everybody kind of thought he was going to be a baseball player. And then he just developed, you know, did a great job. Our school has a great football program. We played all over the country. At one point, we had a 154-game win streak. We won 7 state championships. And Tyler was the first athlete, the first quarterback in probably about 10 or 12 years to start both his junior and his senior year for us. For the previous 12 years, it was always a senior. So I think, you know, when Tyler came in, he was special.
And what's the name of the high school coach?
Hamilton High School in Chandler, Arizona.
So you guys also produced Brock Purdy, is that right?
No, Brock Purdy came out of the school down the street from us, Perry High School.
Okay.
We had Terrell Suggs came from Hamilton, Cody Bellinger, some names you might recognize. So we've had some good athletes come out of our school.
So tell me about, it seems like when you talk about the baseball player and he was going to be a baseball player, and then you mentioned the word athlete, this guy is a pure athlete first, right? And then football player, or how would you phrase that?
You know, I think he's a very athletic quarterback because I think his decision making and his leadership ability puts him in a different category as far as him being a thinking athlete. But, you know, obviously physically, I mean, you got a 6'5 guy who's about 225 and runs a 4.640 and can throw a deep ball as good as anybody I've ever seen. So I think you got a little bit of both there with Tyler.
Was he one of these guys in high school, and we've had him here with Leonard Fournette and some others, I just use him as an example because I saw him play in high school, that was a man among boys you could tell right away?
You know, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. We've had some good athletes. I think Tyler was obviously ahead of the game, but I don't think he really developed all the physical tools where he is now until after he graduated. You know, he wasn't quite that tall. He wasn't quite that big. He always could run and throw. But I wouldn't put him in that category.
Tell me about personality, work ethic, all that kind of stuff.
Well, again, he's the kind of guy that his positivity and his team-oriented approach is it's collective. You know, kids want to be around him. He's the kind of guy that's a natural leader. I think he obviously overcomes adversity as good as anyone I've ever been around, and he did that at a very young age. And to be able to have that grit to stick to it and, you know, be able to set those short-term goals but always have your eye on the finish line, I think Tyler was very mature for his age.
What kind of adversity did he have to overcome?
Well, we had a situation that occurred at our high school, and it was actually a hazing situation. And they let our head coach, who had been here a long time, go. I was a coach in the program, and I had been a head coach at another high school. I'm also an assistant principal, so I wore a bunch of hats. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of put into that position of being head coach for Tyler's senior year. We had a lot of kids leave the program. We kept a few of our best athletes stayed true to their school, which was one was Tyler. So being able to deal with those, negative things that were surrounding our program at that time, and everybody licking their chops thinking, oh, we're going to get a shot at Hamilton. They're not going to be the powerhouse they usually are. And then have Tyler be the leader of that group and, take us into the playoffs and win a couple games. I think we exceeded expectation based upon what had happened that previous year.
When you watched him through college and followed him through college, was there anything that surprised you?
I was surprised he got hurt so often, you know, mm-hmm. And it was just those kind of bad luck, goofy things. And fortunately, no knees or no anything like that. But, you know, when you a break here, break there, it's like, God, give this kid a break, you know. And, you know, wherever he went, he obviously mastered the system they were running. And so my thing with Tyler was every time he was healthy, he played great. And then he'd have this unfortunate setback. But again, with that, I think sometimes those things make you better in the long run.
What's the old saying? It's not about how many times you get knocked down, it's how many times you get up.
Exactly.
To be clear, Tyler had nothing to do with the hazing incident, right?
Absolutely not. No, he wasn't involved in that whatsoever.
So let's talk about personality-wise. Is he a funny guy? Is he a serious type, a studious type? Tell me about him, Dick.
Great, great personality. Again, I think he's got a great sense of humor when he focuses, when it's time. I think he knows how to turn it on and turn it off. Mm-hmm. You know, some guys know when it's time to focus, and they're easy to get focused, and boom, I'm back on it. And then there's other guys that they can't, once it starts getting fun, or I guess you could call it, they can't get back. And I think he can turn it on and turn it off really well, which I think endears him to his teammates and his coaches because he knows how to go, okay, now it's time to go to work.
Yeah, let's talk about leadership abilities and qualities and those kind of things. What did you see in him then?
I think they say, you know, leaders are made. Well, he was a quarterback anyway, so obviously that's a leadership position. But always in control, never too high, never too low. It didn't matter if we were ahead or behind. He was going to make plays that would help us. And I think he was also real positive to his teammates, the kind of guy that would encourage guys, but also not be afraid to say, hey, here's what we got to do. Let's get on it. Quit screwing around. Let's get focused and do what we need to do.
Practice habits. Last guy there. First one there. Studied a lot of film, a lot of weightlifting. Yeah. Tell me about him.
I think, you know, we talked. I hung out with Tyler for about an hour and a half on the first day of the draft. Mm-hmm. And we were talking, and, you know, his biggest thing was, you know, the injuries really helped me understand how much work coaches put in. And it really helped me learn to watch film even better and understand what people are looking for. So even when he was down and couldn't, you know, play, he was still taking opportunities to better his game and become a better quarterback.
Can you tell me some stories, instances, either on or off the field that you remember and are typically Tyler, if you will?
Well, Tyler was the guy that, you know, we had our situation that I said, and the kids that remained were great kids. Unfortunately, they dealt with the rest of the situation and those individuals. So we were coming back from that, and I came in with a very disciplined approach. I'm kind of one of those old school guys, and maybe a little more disciplined than it was. And Tyler was the guy. I'd be like, all right, Tyler, you guys are going to screw up here. And he would look at me and go, no, we're not, coach. And I go, yes, you are. And then I'm going to give everybody up down. So you got to be on board with this because I'm trying to make a point here. And, you know, he was one of those guys, I think, that it was mature enough to be able to understand the big picture and be able to lead you through that. And then, you know, have his teammates understand what was going on and why we were doing specific things. So those are the biggest things I remember about him. You know, he was getting recruited by everybody too. So that was a huge positive for us in that particular time of turmoil.
What do you think his biggest strength is going to be going into the NFL, or biggest strengths?
I don't know. I think his running ability is great because it's you know, you're not expecting that, but he can. And, you know, with the way it is now, the defense can't hit quarterbacks anyway. And you wonder why the running quarterback is thriving in the NFL. Well, those guys used to get crushed, RG3, and they'd be out of the game in 3 years. Well, now they can't hit them. So now you can do that. So to have a guy who can throw that kind of a deep ball and has all the arm angle passes, and, you know, if you flush him from the pocket, you might have a problem containing him. I think those things are going to make him special.
What's going to be his biggest challenges, some of the challenges he'll face heading into the NFL?
I think like anybody in the NFL, you know, the speed of everybody else, obviously it's ramped up. The best guy of every team in every college is in the NFL. There's not some guys who are average or lower. So I think catching up with all of those things for any new young quarterback, that's, I think, definitely a stepping stone. But again, I think Tyler's been able to adjust to everything else he's dealt with. So I don't see that being a problem. But I would think for any quarterback, that's your biggest concern in your early years.
It's hard to compare anybody to anybody, but if you were to take everything together, put it all in one big amalgam of leadership, skills, athletic ability, type of play, can you give me some names of quarterbacks that he would remind you of?
You know, I want to say Roethlisberger, but I think he's a better runner and he's not quite as big. I think he throws a deep ball like Peyton Manning. I thought Peyton Manning was a great deep ball passer. He could throw that, and Tyler throws a great deep ball. I mean, it's always right there. And then, you know, and then I watch the arm angles and all that stuff, and that's just the new game. So you look at those guys that can do those different things. You know, Mahomes from Texas Tech. I mean, Tyler played at Texas Tech. Is he a Mahomes? No, but can he throw those different arm angles and hit those difficult passes? Yes. So, I mean, right off the top of my head, I would say I see a little bit of those three.
If I were to ask you where Tyler's going to be a year from now, what we're going to be talking about, what would you say?
I think he's going to be the starting quarterback of the New Orleans Saints.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dick. Any final thoughts?
No, man. I appreciate it, and I think you guys are going to love him down there, and I can't wait to go to New Orleans and watch some games.
I hope so. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Pardon me. That's Dick Banaszewski, Tyler Shough's high school head coach. We'll take a break. Pardon me. I'll get something to drink. And then we'll find out what Don Dubuque's got coming up. He's in for Newell today here on WWL.